I thank you for the opportunity to be with you tonight, and I hope and pray that the time we spend together will draw us closer to God. When we think about families, we think about the very core structure of how God decided to build society and even the church. Out of all the ways that he could describe the church, he oftentimes used words that describe family. He is introduced to us as our heavenly Father. Christ is called our brother. We are adopted into his family. I do not wish to bring up any bad memories for any of us, but I just want to make a very clear point. What if every child that grew up in a home attending the Lord's church while they grew up was still faithful today? How large, and if all of them were still faithful, how vibrant would the Lord's church be today? I want to encourage you throughout this session as parents, as grandparents, as a church family that has elementary age, middle school, and high school age children in your midst, it is only right that when we hear the Great Commission from the lips of our Lord Jesus, that we seek to go into all the world. But let us never forget how important the next generation is that's inside our doors, that's inside our rooms, that's inside our families, that's inside our church family. What we believe truly shapes who we are, what we do. And so tonight, I want us to spend some time not just talking about what we do. I want us to spend some time talking about what we believe. If we were going to think about parenting and the way that it impacts the next generation, perhaps the most important part of parenting is by simply taking off the ing. That's the most important part of parenting. It's parents. What do you believe? What you believe will greatly, heavily impact the next generation. When we think about stories that just hit us the wrong way, a few years ago, there was a young woman named Ebony Wilkerson, who later we learned had a lot of issues going on in her life, even pertaining to mental illness. But she was on a beach here in Florida, even though she was originally from South Carolina. She was driving her children down the road, and she decided to take a right turn and drive onto a public beach and not steer parallel to the beach, but drive directly into the beach. As a matter of fact, eyewitnesses heard the 9 and 10-year-old yelling out of the window as they were approaching the water, "Help us! Help us! Mama is trying to kill us!" She drove, as you can see from this picture even better, to where the water was coming over the front of the van. She climbed out of the window and stood there. And it was the lifeguard and other eyewitnesses that ran and opened the rear of the van and began to rescue the children. The lifeguard is seen here carrying the older two. It wasn't the mother. It was the older two children that told the other adults there, "There's still a 3-year-old in the van." And they ran back, and just in time, they rescued the 3-year-old also. Why does that story concern us, bother us? Why does it cause us to pause and take notice? Why is it that those particular stories, you don't just turn the television very quickly, but you linger for a few moments to hear what happened? Is everybody okay? One of the reasons is because it involves one of the most precious gifts that God gives us, the gift of children. But second, it captures our attention because it's the very one that we expect to nurture and protect is the one that is harming the children. But now let's think about it from a spiritual standpoint. From a spiritual standpoint, how well are we doing at nurturing and providing, or how much harming is taking place through neglect. What if we could see spiritual neglect today in the same way we see physical neglect in the lives of children? How irritated do we become? How much do we put our foot down and say, somebody's got to do something, when a child is being neglected and malnurtured physically? But how many of us will allow our next door neighbor's children that we know are not being nurtured spiritually, and we don't do anything? Do you realize how many faithful Christians there are today because someone loved them enough to invite them and give them a ride to church 3 times a week the entire time that they were growing up? That happens because there are Christians that are determined to not know children that are starving spiritually. They're neglected spiritually without doing something about it. I hope that you'll give consideration to the children that live around you, and I hope that you would make a commitment to do everything that you can do to bring them closer to the Lord. But let's think for a moment about your children. The children that might be in your home. Between birth and 18 years of age, there are about 58,200 waking hours. Now, if we back out the 3,700 so hours that they might spend in worship and in Bible class, that backs it down to about 54,456 hours. Now, as we think about that, I ask you to think, what do you do during those times? Parents, are your children neglected spiritually during those times, or are they nourished spiritually? But now, for just a moment, I also don't want you to just think about what we do. As you think about this, and we're going to get real clear in this in a moment. If it seems vague, we're leading to it. Just stay with me. But I want you to think about, what do your children experience out of those 54,000 hours that they spend outside of worship, outside of Bible class, but they're awake and they're in your care? What do they experience because of who you are, because of what you believe? Now, let's go ahead and make a very clear point here, a disclaimer. We can raise children in the way that they should go, but now when they're an adult, they're going to have to make a decision if they're going to serve the Lord. If we didn't believe in that, we'd believe in once saved, always saved. You just start them out right in their teenage years, and they have to be a Christian the rest of their life. I would guess that all of us have seen individuals that were given the right background that decided in their life to not follow. I know it's not an exact parallel to what we're talking about, but when I think about this, I can't help but think of one of the most famous women on the face of this earth today. She's made more money in the entertainment industry year after year than most anyone alive today. Her stage name is Katy Perry. Her parents, Keith and Mary Hudson, do not agree with her life at all. Her dad is recorded as saying that he went to one of her concerts that was outdoor, and he stood back on the hill and he watched thousands upon thousands of people cheer and stand and sing and sway. And he said that he cried and cried and cried. Because you see, she was raised going to church 3 times a week. She didn't miss Bible camps, retreats. They had devotionals in their home. And she lives a very, very different life than the faith in which she was reared. Yes, it's a reality that we all have to choose. But still, I ask you, what are we offering to our children? Because most children, when both parents believe the right things about God, the percentage gets up as high as 90% remain faithful in the Lord's church. The proper focus to raise children that love the church is for the parents to focus on the Lord and for their life to be a godly influence in all that they do and for their actions to show the children God. A few years ago, I saw a simple illustration that was this pyramid of life was the idea. And as I got to looking at this and studying it over, I got to thinking about the book of Ephesians, and I got to thinking about the book of Colossians, and I got to thinking about spiritual life. And for me, it was one of those aha moments that kind of changed the way I approached a lot of my study in Scripture so far as applying it to my life. I want you to notice here that there is a line between the very top of the pyramid and the second layer there. And you notice that dotted line says all the things above are visible and all the things below are invisible. As parents, how much time do we spend talking with our children about the things that are visible, and how much time do we spend talking with our children about the things that are not visible? Bible class teachers, elders and deacons and preachers, how much time do we spend talking about the actions of people? We talk to the teenagers and we talk to them about their actions. But now let's pause for a moment and see the foolishness of that if it's void of the other two most important parts. You realize no action is an island to itself. Every action is connected to a value system. And values are not islands to themselves. Every value is connected to a belief. You want to change someone's action long term? You have to change their beliefs. Now, I know I'm going to pop somebody's bubble here tonight, and I'm sorry, I'm with you. My bubble's been popped on this, but that ship has already sailed. Knowledge has come in. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand but if you're one of those that gets really fired up about New Year's resolutions, this is why they never last past January. Like, why are the gyms full in January but not February? Why are the diets gung-ho in January but not February? Why is money going in savings account in January but it's not in February? It's because people have tried to take the top tier of the pyramid and say, we're going to focus on that this year. And you can't do that. Listen to me. You can't do that. Actions are not islands to themselves. They are attached to your values. Let's be really extreme here just to make a point. What if I said to you, hey, right down the road here, there is a convenience store that's about to make a deposit drop. I think if you and I would go in there, we could rob it and each walk away with maybe $3,000 or $4,000. Will you help me? We'll go right now. And you'll say, there's no way I'm going to do that. I said, don't worry. We'll just kill all the witnesses. We can't get caught. Listen, it's no problem. We'll just rob a little bit, murder a little bit, and we'll walk away with thousands of dollars. So now are you with me? He said, listen, you can do all the talking you want. There is no way you're going to convince me to go rob a store and murder the witnesses. And I just ask you why. We've described two actions that you say there is no way you'll do them. Why? You have a value system that is against those two things. And your value system, now you've got to figure this out. Does your value system just go down to a patriotic system? Well, I believe that what made America great was people being honest, and so I'm just not going to do that. Or does your value system go down? See, it's what you believe. It always goes back to what you believe. Maybe you say, well, you know, I just come from a good family, and my grandparents wouldn't have done that. My mom and dad wouldn't do that. We're just good neighbors. We're good people, and we wouldn't do that. Or is your value system, I know what God has said about this. And I believe our yes ought to be yes and our no ought to be no. And I believe that we should not be stealing. Instead, we should be working and even having money to give to those who is in need. I believe life, that there's a sanctity to it, and we shouldn't be taking life. Now, you know what we would all hope for each other is that the reason you wouldn't do those two actions is because your beliefs come from God. That shaped your values. That now your actions stem from that. We don't have to preach a whole lot about not robbing convenience stores, do we? Because the belief and the values. I'm not suggesting you, by any stretch of the imagination, that with our children, whether we're a Bible class teacher or a parent or a grandparent, that we shouldn't be speaking to them about specific actions. But I am suggesting this to you, that if you talk frequently about actions that you do want them to do or you don't want them to do, but you have not first taught them a belief system that shapes their values, you have set them up for failure. And so the first place as parents we have to start is, what do we believe? How has this shaped my life? What are my core values from my belief in God? And let that be the action that my children see every day. I'm going to mention this very briefly. This could be a long illustration, and we just don't have time for it right here. But George Barna, several years ago, did research on children that were in their early 20s, mid-20s, that were very, very committed to the faith from which they grew up. And so he decided to do a study to see what is it that made these children stick with their faith even into adulthood when it was their own decision. Well, this began a questioning process then of their parents. And what was revealed in this study, which ended up being two different books, was the most important thing about children hanging on to a great faith even into their adulthood had more to do with how the parents parented, if that's a word, rather than how the children made decisions on their own. It really is amazing. Here is what he noted that the parents did that raised godly children that carried out the faith in which they grew up. The parents were the most likely parents to raise spiritual champions. The parent themselves genuinely loved God. I want you to notice what we're going to read here. It's not about a Sunday religion. Oh, just go to church on Sunday and just be a good neighbor and just don't get into big trouble. No, it's genuine. They genuinely loved God. The parents did. The parents prayed daily. The parents worshiped regularly. The parents read the Bible habitually. Now notice this. For personal development. They participated in the life of a spiritual community. We would call that church. They applied their resources, their spiritual gifts, and their natural abilities frequently to influence others' lives. And there was much God talk in their homes. In other words, when you picture that right there, a belief that shapes values, that shapes your actions, I want you to jot a note. And if you don't have anything you're studying right now on a daily basis, I want you to jot a note of that pyramid, and I want you to read through, not slowly, sometime this week, this coming week, I want you to read through Colossians, and I want you to read through Ephesians, and I want you to notice how both of these books spends the first half of the book talking about what you're going to believe, and then the last half of the book talks about, if you believe this, this is what you will do. The books are just naturally broken down into halves. Of course, Colossians is a little bit shorter, so you see the first two chapters spends a lot of time on theology. What do you believe about God? And then there's going to be a lot of application. The third chapter and on. If you've been risen with Christ, seek those things which are above. And you go from there of talking about very practical things that we would do. In other words, the last half concentrates a whole lot on the very top of the pyramid. The first half of the book concentrates a whole lot on the lower two sections of the pyramid. Same thing with Ephesians. The first three chapters, the lower part of the pyramid. The last three chapters are the upper part of the pyramid. It really is powerful. Now, with this in mind, what I want to do, if you'll be turning to Psalm 78, I want to show you two passages tonight that are not unique when we study the topic of parenting. Psalm 78 and Deuteronomy 6 would come to a lot of our minds. And so for the last few minutes that we have here in this session, I want us to look at these two. But I do not want us to try to break down everything that's said in them, but I want us to really bring out two major points as we look through. And I know both of these are simple now, but think about this. The first thing I want you to see is God's plan has always been an effort almost to kind of grab us by the shoulders and say, church, I'm trying to reach you, the adult generation. Will you believe in my son Jesus? And once the church responds, lays down their life and says, Lord, I believe in you. I want to be adopted through your son into your family. The next thing the Lord has always said, now reach the next generation. And again, I'm not trying to minimize the importance of going to all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. But just as real as that is also as real as God always expects you and I to be concerned about the next generation. And we see that so strong in Psalm 78. We see it so strong in Deuteronomy 6. We see it even in Ephesians 6 and 4 when he's telling fathers to bring up your children. What's he saying? He's saying, fathers, I expect you to reach the next generation. And so here's how we see it here in Deuteronomy, the 78th chapter. As we look at this, I want you to notice in the first three verses, there's about nine different ways, if we were just going to look at words that he says about like ear or hear or mouth or utter or sayings. There's about nine ways in the first three verses that he is saying to the present generation, I've given you the message. It's been passed to you by the generation before you. Here's how he says it, verse 1. Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I'll utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known. And our fathers have told us. Can you emphasize it any more than what he's emphasized in those three verses? Nine times he's saying, my message has come to you. My message has been said to you. My message, your fathers has given this message to you. Okay, Lord, I hear you. What do you want me to do with it? Verse 4. We will not hide them from their children. Let that simmer. We will not hide them from their children. Telling the generation to come, act right. That's not what he said, is it? What do we tell the next generation? Dads and moms, grandparents, when's the last time you've sat down and this is what you told the next generation? High school, middle school teachers, when's the last time you sat down and this is what you told the next generation? Telling the generation to come, the praises of the Lord and His strength and His wonderful works that He has done. One thing that really provoked me to study this deeper than I had previously studied it was about three times in one calendar year. I heard of a young person, about 17, 18, 19, or 20 years old, that had grown up hearing my preaching. And now they say they don't even believe God exists. And so through a broken heart, I began to evaluate myself. How is it that I could preach every Sunday morning and every Sunday night, and even from time to time teach the high school class, and someone could grow up and say, "You never convinced me. I don't think he exists." I'm going to begin to break this text down. That word marvelous. Do you notice there at the end of 4, and it depends what translation you're reading, it says, "and his wonderful works." How much time do we spend telling our children why we praise the Lord? How much time do we spend telling them how strong God is, His strength? And one of the ways to do that is that third thing there in verse 4, His wonderful works. His wonderful works in Hebrew is pala. It's the same word over there in the 12th verse where he says, marvelous things that he did in the sight of their fathers. And we're not finished this. I just want you to see where he's going. And the text is going to explain itself here. But I just want you to see this. And again, I don't want you to think, wow, this preacher's lost it. He doesn't think we ought to talk to our kids about what you shouldn't do and what you should. Absolutely, those things have to be covered. But I'm just saying, we have got to stop and evaluate, what do we even believe? And what are we trying to get our children to do? Are we trying to get them to act like a Christian, or are we trying to get them to become a Christian? I would encourage all of us, if we still use the phrase, act like a Christian, to eradicate that 100%. As long as we live, let us never say those words. Unless we're teaching someone not to say those words. Do you realize acting like you're a Christian is the very core of hypocrisy? Why should you have to act like a Christian if you believe that shaped your core values, you will be a Christian? And anytime we're pleading with our kids, go out on Friday night and just act like a Christian. No. No. Be a Christian. And what you believe and what you value. And so let's jump back into the text here. So in 5, he established a testimony in Jacob. He appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded to our fathers, that they should make them, what's this? Get it down to the next generation. That they should make them known to their children. That the generation to come, what? Might know them. The children who would be born. That they may arise and declare them to their children. Did you catch that? He jumped a generation. He says, I want you that know it to teach your children. And by the way, while you're teaching your children, go ahead and teach them that they're going to teach their children. I remember before the seatbelt law, standing up in the back seat, leaned over the front seat, talking to mom and dad, and my mama was drilling us like an army sergeant about what kind of spouse we would marry. I was like 7 years old. How faithful a Christian they would be, how they would love the Lord, and how we would have a marriage from day one that loved the Lord, and we would raise children that loved the Lord. I didn't know that she was teaching me Psalm 78, but she was. Verse 7, that they may set... Now, by the way, here's the big three in this passage, okay? What are we going to teach our children? This isn't the pyramid exactly, but the principle is right here of the pyramid in verse 7. That they may Number one, teach them how to act. No. First thing you do, that they may set their hope in God and not forget the works of God. But now finally we've reached the top of the pyramid. But keep His commandments. Why is that one listed third and not first? Who's going to keep the commandments of a God that they don't know and of a God they don't trust? But if our children are taught to know God, well, how can you know that He's trustworthy? Tell me of the great works that He's done. Works like whenever they told their children in verse 8, 9, and 10, He talked about people that, like from children of Ephraim, that they didn't believe God. So in 11, they forgot His works. And notice His wonders. That's another word for the marvelous things God does. But then in verse 12, here's what we should remember. This is what Israel should remember. He says, marvelous things that He did in the sight of their fathers in the land of Egypt. He's saying, this is what I want you to teach your children. I want you to teach them about how great God is. I want you to teach them that you can trust God. I want you to teach them how powerful God is. Verse 13, He does things like this. He divided the sea and caused them to pass through. And He made the water stand up like a heap. And then notice how He guided them. In the daytime, He led them with a cloud. In the night, with a light of fire. Notice how He provided. 15, He split the rocks in the wilderness. He gave them drink in abundance like the depths. And He also brought streams out of the rocks. And He caused waters to run down like the rivers. What is He saying here? He's saying, have you told your children how marvelous Paula's idea of so distinguished, so set apart, it's like a wonder, it's like a miracle. Your average person can't do this. The only people that can do things are the only one that can do things this grand and this big. It's like Nicodemus saying, you must be from God. Does our children know God? So strong, so marvelous, that it's just natural we praise Him. And here are the children of Israel. He's throwing it out and He's saying, I've taught you this present generation. Reach back and teach your children and teach them to teach your children. God, what do you want us to teach them? I want you to teach them of, you can put your hope in me. Right there, think this way. You can trust me. I don't know, God. I face some big things in life. I face some tough issues. I'm bigger than anything you face. You can trust me. Put your hope in me. And if you need to be reminded, get your parents to teach you of all the works that I have done, and you will draw this conclusion. I trust God. And when you get there, then get your parents to teach you my commandments. And you show me a 17-year-old that they believe who God truly is. They know the works that He's done. They trust Him with all their heart. The top of that pyramid is going to be pretty easy for them. There's not a 17-year-old on this earth that will keep the top of that pyramid if they do not trust God. I know we would say, I teach my children. I teach them to trust God. But I want you to just really think about, if you're hearing your children from their mindset and they're hearing you talk, which one do they hear that you really trust? You know, like when you speak with urgency, when you speak with great importance, when you speak deep desires of your heart, do they hear about your trust in God? Or do they hear about your trust in education? Do they hear about your trust in physical fitness? Do they hear about your trust and just a focus and a determination that nobody can quench? Or do they hear about your trust in monetary worth? Do they hear about your trust getting the right job at the right place? Listen here, son. Listen here, daughter. If you got to get that scholarship. So let me tell you, you get that scholarship, you can go to the school. And if you go to that school, nobody can take your education away from you. If you do good there, you're going to get on at this company. If you do there, in a matter of time, you'll be making six digits. And let me tell you something, you get your education, you get your experience. Let me tell you, you're set for life. Really? Really, that's what you put your trust in. Hey, as long as my kid does that, we're doing good. And then we get in a church setting and we start backpedaling. And, well, I don't mean really. I'm just saying I want them to do it. Well, which way do we want it to be? Where do you place your trust? Are you content for your child to dig ditches? As long as they trust God with all of their being. Does your kid know that? Do they know for you there's only one thing in life that's non-negotiable to your peace and your satisfaction? And you can echo the words of the great Apostle Paul. To know that my children walk in truth. And your children know that that's where your trust is. 100%. That's where your belief is. And that has shaped all of your values. And that's why your actions are what they are today. I know that we're kind of out of time, so I'm just going to show you this one. You know the passage well, most likely. Turn over to Deuteronomy, the sixth chapter. You might remember Deuteronomy, the sixth chapter. Deuteronomy, the sixth chapter, we usually, when we're speaking about parenting, or maybe I should say I do, I can't speak for all of you, you may not do this, but for years, I would speak about parenting or about children, teaching children, I'd go to Deuteronomy 6, and for the most part, I would camp out in verse 7. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. And that's a great passage, and there's so much that should instruct us as parents. But do you realize the first six verses, what he's doing is he's speaking to the present generation. And he's speaking to the present generation like in verse 2. Do you fear God? Or in verse 3, are you willing to hear, O Israel, to observe carefully? Do you believe the last part of verse 3, the promises that God makes to you? Do you trust His promises? In verse 5, do you love the Lord your God with all of your soul, all of your heart, all of your soul, and all of your strength? And are these words which I command you today, are they in your heart? Think about 2, 3, and 4, or 5 there. Fear, hear, and love. Why? Because in verse 6, they're supposed to be in our heart. Is that where we are as the adult generation? I fear God with all of my being. I want to hear anything that God says, not because I worship the top of the pyramid. I don't worship the commandments of God. I worship God who gives those commandments. God, if you speak, I want to hear you because I believe in you. Lord, I trust you. You say it, and that's my value system. Give your commandments and I will hear. How much do you trust me? I love you with all my heart, all my soul, all my mind. And then if that's the case, we come down to verse 7. If we have children, he says, now reach the next generation. So what do we do? Parents are to become teachers. They are to be teachers that help children learn, and this learning is to be of great diligence. Now, the task of diligence is, diligence kind of comes from two angles. One angle is it comes from high priority. A second is it comes from hard work. You only can't imagine how true this illustration is I'm about to give you, and I wish it wasn't. It's kind of like one of my goals this year, and boy, we're getting late in the year. I don't know what's going to happen. I told my wife like several months ago, I said, you know one of the things I want to accomplish this year? She said, well, I said, I want to clean my garage up. Right now I could tell you, I'm really diligent about cleaning my garage up. Like, I really wanted to, and I've been planning on it. I'm really diligent. All I have to do right now is hit the buttons. And you know what? You get one glance, say, I can tell you what, you're not diligent about cleaning your garage up. It hasn't been the highest priority, and it hasn't been a great labor of work. Not yet. But I hope for the end of the year, to some degree, it's a higher diligence and a higher labor. How are we supposed to teach our children? We're supposed to teach our children with diligence. It's supposed to be high priority. It's supposed to be great labor. But now I want you to notice who's supposed to be doing this. It's only parents that already fear God, a great, awesome respect for God, because they know how strong He is. And they know His marvelous works. And they don't praise Him because it's an exercise on Sunday. They can't help but praise Him every day of their life because they've put their whole trust in Him. And so they love God with all of their being. And the actions that they carry out in their life is because of their belief and because of their values. And so now the Lord is saying to people that are already totally devoted to Him, He says, I want you to reach down to the next generation. And I want you to see that not only are you a parent, you are to be a teacher. It's not optional. You must be a teacher. And you must teach this diligently to your children. Okay, I'm willing. Where's the classroom? He says, you're going to love this. The classroom is when you're at home. And when you're going about your way, it's when you're going to bed at night, when you rise in the morning. Devotional times with children is very appropriate and very helpful. But that's a totally different thing than what Deuteronomy 6 is talking about. Deuteronomy 6 is talking about people that are living that pyramid. And they naturally go through their days teaching their children by the way they live, by the way they talk, and they're constantly showing their children the marvelous works of God. If we had the ability to show our children God, for who He really is, would they then turn their back on Him? I know it still would be their decision, but surely that would be a great hope. If you've raised children, you know that you get those unique opportunities every now and then that you treasure with your children. My last child was about to leave home for college a few years ago. And I came in late, and I was telling somebody just the other day, I learned when my kids got to be older high school students, I kind of went through that late 20s, early 30s things of saying, like so many say, I don't know how I did that back in college, you know, where you went to bed really late and got up, you know, and operated on little sleep, and boy, I could never do that again. Well, when my kids got to be in late high school, I realized if I was going to keep a close relationship with them, I was going to have to figure out how to get back on that schedule again. Because if you want your kids, they're 16, 17, 18, to talk with you, you just hang out with them about 10:30 or 11 and they'll just pipe up. Like, it just all of a sudden their mouth starts opening. And so I went through about, 6 months or a year there just trying to get used to that again and knowing what it's like to feel sleepy all day long again. But it was worth it. And so one night, my daughter's in the couch there in the living room, and she's working on her laptop, and that's kind of different because I usually don't bring my work home. That's kind of my deal. But I did that time. I brought my laptop home, and so it's just she and I were the only ones up, and I was working on some things, and I was actually working on a lesson where I was studying through this, some of this for the first time for me in this way. And so I just turned to her and I said, "Hey," I said, "you've brought some of your friends to the Lord, and you've gone to a big public school and lived a faithful Christian life, and you seem to be doing well spiritually. Tell me from your view of a parenting standpoint, what do parents have to do to raise faithful children?" And I thought it was going to be one of those, "Dad, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da," and then turn around and start typing. That's really what I expected. The laptop closed. She said, Indian style, turned sideways on the couch. And she didn't take a breath for the next 30 minutes. And I started typing as fast as I could everything she said. And when I grouped everything that she said 20 different things. But I just want to share with you her number 5. She said, "Dad, it's a big deal to have godly parents. We've all heard, and we know it's true, that what the flight attendant says, that the parent has to put their oxygen mask on first if they're going to be able to help the children." She says, "That's the way it is for parents. Parents must be on point. I know that it's not that way with so many kids, and it's not good." I said to you in the beginning, I'm not asking you to live with regret. But I am asking you today to live with the Lord. And don't ever underestimate the influence that you have left with your children, with your grandchildren, and with that child that lives 2 houses down, that they would come to church with you if you would just invite them. And you may be a parent to them that they will never have, a spiritual parent. And in some ways, you may be able to offer them more than what you even offered your own children. But God's way is really pretty simple. Present generation, believe in me. And then turn and tell the next generation how great I am.